mankind is not just another animal. That's what we're told these days. That's what some of you, if you go to school, will be taught in science. It's what we read in books. It's the assumption, if you listen to the news or read the newspaper. Now, we can't, if we're being honest, deny the physiological, the physical similarities between us and animals like apes and monkeys. They're obvious. We have two arms, two legs, two ears, one mouth, one nose, five digits on each hand. Our skeletons, if you lay them out next to each other, match fairly well, although the bones are proportioned differently. We're told that we're just another animal, even if it happens to be one with a particularly well-developed brain. Now, as a result, if you assume that, we have no idea who or what we are. We've no idea how to deal with important issues like terminal illness or unborn children. If a human being is just another animal, why not put it down when it's in pain, as you would with a dog or a cat? Why not take it out back and shoot it like Old Yeller when it turns nasty and starts to bite? Why not remove those animals from society who start to cost it more than they can contribute? Why not prevent those animals from being born which will inconvenience other mature animals? More and more, our society is struggling with the idea that if we are just another animal, what is the point to anything? You could go and kill yourself or anyone else, and it wouldn't matter one bit in the grand scheme of things, because there is no grand scheme of things. Human life becomes just one cosmic joke, and the only punchline is death. You compare that with what the Bible tells us about mankind. We are not just another animal. We're going to start by looking at the nature of man. If he's not animal, and I will use gendered pronouns, I apologise, I'll be talking about mankind, I'll say man, I'm not going to apologise for that. It's the simplest way to talk about it. I include men and women in that. I feel it's the most biblical way to talk about it as well. We can talk about that afterwards. So when I say man, I mean all of us, men and women, whatever age we are. If man is not animal, mineral or vegetable, what is he? Well, we've already seen how on days 1 to 3 of creation, God made these three different realms of the earth. Now on days 4 to 6, he fills these spheres. He puts a governor in charge of it to define it, to demarcate its boundaries. Now, if you want a more visual picture, this is the kind of thing we should have in our minds. Not necessarily literal, but as a sort of a picture language way of describing the heavens and the earth. We see how God has separated out and filled a wonderful world, a perfect habitat. There are periods of time governed by lights in the sky above. The seas and skies are filled with life. And the fertile land is covered in every kind of animal. But it's clear from this passage, in the sort of 5.5 days that we've got through so far, that all creation up to this point has been building to something. It's all been good in and of itself. There's not been anything bad created. God has said that repeatedly. He saw that it was good. But all that goodness has been in preparation for something, or rather, someone. Now that someone is man. Mankind. the human species. Everything so far has been building towards this. This is why God created the earth, to put man in it. That might seem like a very bold claim to you. It seems almost arrogant, but let me give you the proof from these verses which we read. The first thing we should notice about the nature of man is the then with which verse 26 starts. Perhaps you noticed that as we read through, and if you read days 1 to 3, it will become even clearer. Every other time God speaks and creates something, what does it say? And God said. And God said. Now this is actually a very good bit of English translation. I know I have more of a Hebraist than I am here this morning, so I can show my working here. The Hebrew which opens this verse is exactly the same as that which opens every other verse. There are some translations which do put it, and God said. That's literally the words that you have there. But what follows this "and God said" is phrased so differently. What God says is so different that it strikes like a bullet between the eyes in Hebrew. And it's a good way to translate it in English with "then." It's less literal, but it's a good translation because it makes it much harder to miss that there is something very different happening in verse 26 to what has happened in every verse up to this point. Creation has been made ready for God's finest creation. Similar in some ways, as we've noted, to the animals created on the same day. It's, you know, we're a land creature, if you like. This is the sphere for which we are made. But this makes it crystal clear that whatever similarities we may have, man is a whole category of being higher than the animals. That's why his creation, the creation of man, male and female, is going to be expanded in the next chapter. We need to zoom in on this. This is so important, it can't be missed. So that's one thing. Then, something is different about the nature of man. But we need to remember, and we'll talk more about this in our next point, that man, male and female, is made in the image and likeness of God. Now, there is much more to say about this than we have time to look at this morning. But you see how it marks out man as different to every other created thing. The plants, the fish, the winged birds and the animals, each of them, did you notice, was created according to what? They're all created according to their different kinds. All the many species and types with a kind of family resemblance for every kind of creature. There's a vast plethora of sea creatures. You watch Blue Planet or any of those documentaries, there's incredible biodiversity of the world's seas. All these different looking creatures that have some things in common. They all look like they belong in the sea. Now the same is true for the birds and the animals. That's why we get confused over things like penguins, because they're birds that go swimming and use their wings. There's many different species, but they all have some shared features. They're all made according to their fishy, avian or animal kinds. Mankind is the only thing in all of creation made in the image and likeness of God. Humans, men and women, are somehow like God in a way which nothing else in all creation is. Now, tied to that is the fact that God is described as making man in his image as male and female. There we go. This is significant, the fact that it mentions it. I mean, you would know if it didn't say it here, as you're Israelites there in the wilderness receiving this, you know that there are men and women because you're stood there as men and women. Now, you don't need to be a zoologist today to know that animals come in male and female. You know, maybe you've got a pet that's one or the other. And yet, when they were created, they were not described that way. It doesn't say he created the animals male and female. It's not significant for them in the way that this wonderful difference is significant for man. It's one more thing that lets us know that man has a different nature to the rest of creation. If you want a final proof that all of this has been building towards the creation of man, look at the fact in verse 31 that it's only when God has created man that he looks at everything he's made and declares it not good, but very good. Again, in the Hebrew, a very strong way of phrasing. He looks at all that he's made, and it was very good. Chapter 2, verse 1. Only when God has created man is the heavens and the earth complete. Well, that highlights some of the difference of the nature of man to the rest of creation, but tied very closely to this. You know, why is man made with such a different nature? And it has to do with his function. What God created us for. And this is our second point, the function of man. In ancient times, it was common for kings or great emperors to set up a statue of themselves on the borders of their territory. You know, think of that poem, Ozymandias the Great. Behold my works, ye mighty in despair, all that. Now this statue, this image of the king, set up at these important sites or at the edge of the kingdom, was seen as somehow representative of the king, imbued with his essence. It was as if the king were really there saying, this is mine, beyond that isn't, but this is mine, and it's all mine. Now, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, this is the image that Moses is using to talk about in verses 26 to 27. God is the king of the heavens and the earth. Now, we ought to know that. He made it. He's the king. But he puts man on the earth to represent his rule, to mark it out as his. He creates a being in his own image and likeness to show the extent of his reign over the earth. But rather than a lifeless statue, he creates a living, breathing, rational being, a being which, like him, is plural, male and female in the case of man. A being which is somehow like him, almost divine, a little lower than the angels, as Psalm 8 puts it. But mankind has an even greater purpose and dignity than this alone might suggest. God didn't create man to just stand there and do nothing. He wasn't made to be a statue. He wasn't made to be a slave. Now, those of us who've been here for the rest of this series might remember that I've already mentioned several times how to many ancient religions, man's creation is often described as something of an afterthought. It's something made at the end, not because it's the most important thing to be made, but so he, male and female, can serve the gods. He's made to be a slave. The Israelites have just come out of Egypt. They know slavery. They understand it very well. And they are well aware of the implications of the relationship which God is outlining here. Not animals, not slaves, but kings. Mankind was created with the purpose of ruling the earth as God's representative or his delegate. It's as if mankind is a client king ruling over the earth at the command of God. God didn't need, did he? He didn't need a representative. He could have exercised his authority and rule directly. This is what the picture could have been. You know, God just saying to the animals, this is what you are, this is what you're to do. Saying to the fish, this is what you are, this is what you're to do. He didn't need anyone to go between him and his creation. We know he has the power. He's just created all this. But God didn't choose that option. He chose to delegate his authority through mankind. He put his image bearers on the earth to rule over the earth. It's a sign of his amazing power. It's a sign of his incomparable love and mercy. Sometimes, and we do it in a positive way, but sometimes we talk as if Adam and Eve were put into the garden just to be gardeners, to be manual labourers. I'm not demeaning manual labour, but they weren't just put in the garden to till the earth. Chapter 1 of Genesis makes it very clear that man's function is more exalted than that. He is a king, under God, exercising dominion. We read, don't we, he's to rule over the earth and subdue it. His rule was to extend to every corner of the natural world, over the fish of the seas and the birds of the sky and every beast, wild or domesticated. Don't make the mistake of thinking that this, and especially this word subdue, when I talk about dominance and dominion, this doesn't justify the abuse which we as a species have inflicted on this planet. This rule, the rule of man, Adam's rule, was to be a benevolent rule, a steward caring for his master's precious possession. Now the pattern of leadership described in the Bible is always, if it's positive, described in the terms of servant leadership. Shepherd rule. That's ruling for the benefit of those being ruled. Not to line your own pockets. You think of what we had in our children's talk about Saul. He was a king like all the other kings. A king who ruled over, who lined his own pockets, who sent the young men off to war and wanted to make his own name great. That's not what a king is supposed to look like. Mankind was supposed to govern and beautify the beautiful creation which God had graciously put him in. He wasn't supposed to strip mine it and ruin it and pollute it. Now there are limits to this rule. It's not without borders, is it? Now you notice when God says what they're to do, to rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. And then he says this to man after he's created them. There are limits. It doesn't seem to extend, you notice, to the lights in the sky. Now, it's quite funny that this seems to coincide with all the celebrations about man on the moon and the 50th anniversary and all that. I'm not criticising man's spacefaring efforts or saying that he had no divine right to walk on the moon. That's still part of the natural creation. But it's saying that man is not the master of time. He's not the master of the heavens. He's only ever a client king, an under shepherd. But his role was to be a princely one. All the earth was his. Every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they are yours for food. All the great fruits and vegetables and everything good to eat was man's to enjoy. A home for men and women to govern and care for, and in so doing demonstrate the greatness of the God who had created them. But we have to note a couple of ways our thinking could go wrong here. Now, if you're paying attention, you'll notice that I've started to talk in conditionals. I've started to say, was supposed to, was meant to, would have, should have. Now, if you know the book of Genesis at all, you know that in just a few chapters, just two chapters, this wonderful pattern, this beautiful and grand design is going to go wrong. You know, you could see it, that the arrows are all going to get inverted. Creation is going to tell man what to do, who wants to decide what God ought to do. Now, if, like me, you believe that God is in complete control over every event in history, this presents us with a problem. Is God, in this, setting up mankind for a fall? You could, like many ancient peoples, the Israelites' neighbours, start to imagine God as having a proud or unworthy, a human design in all this. He's given man a job that we, reading this book, know he's going to mess up in a catastrophic way. There are two chief responses to this, and I've put both on the heading of the blessing of man. We've looked at man's nature, his function. Let's look at his blessing. Because from verse 28 onwards, God pronounces his blessing over man. Now, he's making it clear that his purposes for mankind are blessing, happiness, joy, success. They're to enjoy their role, their function. He's supposed to satisfy them as they exercise their privileged role over the earth. Rather than having been created to provide food for the gods, God has created man and provided all the food he could ever want. He's prepared a perfect home for us. We need to understand that God's motives towards man were positive. They were for his blessing, his happiness. We learn here that God isn't arbitrary or fickle, just turning on a dime, changing his mind at the drop of a hat. He's not ill-disposed towards us, like he's trying to trick man just so he can lord it over him. When we look at the world and the mess that we all know it is now in, we should know that we can't lay the blame at God's feet. But we still keep coming back to the fact that this blessing, in a sense, wasn't going to happen. God knew, if he's in charge, he knew that Adam wasn't going to perfectly exercise his authority over the earth. I mean, who created the snake? He knew Adam would end up rebelling against him at the instigation of a lesser created thing over which Adam should have been exercising this dominion. Now, why show us this perfect pattern in the first place when we know it's going to be snatched away so suddenly? It's like, you know, a game show host saying to someone who's just been knocked out of the competition, "Let's see what you could have won." If one mistake is misreading God's intentions, then the other related mistake is assuming that this plan had to be scrapped after Adam rebelled in the garden. We might assume, knowing the early chapters of Genesis, that God had an amazing plan A for mankind that the devil spoiled. So he needed a plan B to save anything from the rubble. As we work through Genesis, I want you to realise that there isn't and there never was any plan B. Jesus was not sent into the world to save a handful after God's initial plans went awry, like stripping assets from a failing business. The gospel of salvation is not an inferior alternative to provide the blessing which God wasn't able to through Adam. Jesus is the one who fulfills the blessings pointed to in these verses. God's plan was always that there be a man to rule over the earth on his behalf. And in Jesus, those plans find their full and complete fulfillment, perfected in a way we only ever see hinted at in the first Adam. All of Scripture points us forward to Christ. It helps us see his beauty, his majesty, his awesome power, and the extent of his reign. As we consider God's creation pattern for the blessing of mankind in the first creation, we see with greater clarity the surpassing blessing of the new creation to come. It's like everything before is just helping us to understand better what comes after. We see that, in a sense, the creations of the heavens and the earth was just preparing us for the promise of the new heavens and the new earth. I mean, you think about which state will last longer. However old the earth is, whether it's thousands or millions or billions of years old, it doesn't matter. That time will fade into nothing versus the new heavens and the new earth. We see in the second Adam a king whose reign doesn't just extend over the birds and fish and beasts, but into eternity, into infinity. His dominion, his reign, is to be ubiquitous. There is no place, no domain, no realm or sphere where Christ is not king. We discover that we who are created in the image and likeness of God can, in Jesus Christ, be united to God. We see God display his glory, his grace, his kindness, and invite sinners like us into the most unimaginable blessing. In Adam, as we'll see in a few weeks, all mankind fell. But the glory we would have known had the first Adam never fallen was only ever a signpost to the greater glory to come. The dignity granted to mankind through being made in the image of God pales to what is brought about in us when we are remade in the image of Christ, who is, as the New Testament tells us, the image of God. This is God's grand scheme, and it always was. If these promises aren't yet yours, because you know that Jesus is not your king, then turn away from whatever it is that you're trying to use to make yourself happy. Call out for mercy and turn to him while there's still time. But if you look forward to the new heavens and the new earth as a home you know is guaranteed by the blood of this perfect Saviour, and turn your lips to praise and make your life an offer of worship to the one who has, according to this perfect plan A, achieved and eternally secured these things. Let's sing our final hymn. 491, as we confess, Jesus shall reign where'er the sun does his successive journeys run, his kingdom stretch from shore to shore, till the moons shall wax and wane no more, and we might add, and beyond. Let's stand and sing.